This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Were you always that good at getting that much stuff out of a topic?
No. I just realised, and you know, it was around the time. I think I just realised that you need to get more out of it, and there's more you can do with it. Like, and even then, it is the first thing that goes. Like, when you get rusty, you can do the routines, but you fall back into just asking a quick question and getting out and going.
You get a laugh and you bail.
Yeah. I remember discussing this once with Adam Hills, and he says the same thing. He says, I always, no matter what they say, I say fantastic.
I just released an episode with Nina Conti at Soho Theatre. She said exactly the same thing. Whatever they say, you grin and you go, brilliant.
Brilliant. That's an amazing thing you do. But it is it's basic improv. I am accepting your suggestion.
Yes, and. Yeah, sure.
And here we go. So you go, fantastic. Now let's find the thing that makes that. Plus it buys you a second to go, fucking hell.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, the greater problem with it is that... people have now got more technical jobs than they ever had.
Yes, material science has come up in the last two gigs I was in. I've not heard the phrase before.
Great, I love it.
And then material science.
Nanotubes. I would just be standing there shouting, nanotubes.
Graphene!
Yeah, great. Oh, soon we'll just be wrapped in this thing. And we'll not know why, but we were told it was great. It helps to be curious, I suppose, and have a certain general curiosity with people's lives. There is a difficulty, and I've said this is a line I've said on stage, that the ideal person is somebody whose job appeared in a Richard Scarry book or similar. Any book called Things We Make and Do. Jobs you learned as a child. It's because you'll see if somebody goes, well, I renumerate a database, and the audience have no idea. Whereas if you actually meet a fireman, the fucking eruption in the room of just... Because people have so much questions they already have themselves about it. So it's trying to ask the questions the audience didn't realize they were really interested in, and doing that at the end.
And with a reluctant audience member, I noticed at the beginning of your This Is The Show, on the DVD of that, there is the first person, or maybe the second person you talk to, you spend a lot of time with, is clearly pretty uncomfortable. He's nervously looking, he's answering questions. But you completely... steamroller isn't the right word, but you don't let him off the hook at all. And it struck me that there's only probably two people in front of him who are looking round who can see he's uncomfortable. And you don't even let on that he doesn't want to say anything.
No,
because
absolutely.
Obviously you're playing to 3,000 people.
Yeah,
you're just smiling at him, and you're just you're kind of mentally painting a happy face on him, or are you just thinking?
Screw
your happiness.
The reason is that internally there's a part of me really unhappy about it, but it's the reality of when you record the DVD, it's a brighter night. The lighting has to be much brighter to see them, so the whole room just is bright, and you can sometimes get it come down quietly, but for the initial part in particular, and the night before you do the DVD, it's the things they say. The things they say are remarkable, and they're enthusiastic, and they love it. We've always had the option of removing it, though. It's always been there in the DVD, people just freeze. Mm-hmm. I remember once recording a DVD we never released because it was a mess of it. And it was in a cold theatre in Dublin, and it was very early anyway, so it predated any of the DVDs that did come out. But there was a woman there, and there was a young lad there, and I was joking with him because his mum had brought him, and I was joking about, he was 14 or 12 or something like that. And I said, you terrible parent bringing a child to a thing like this. And he got a big laugh and all that. This is very much a story about Ireland as anything else, was in my kitchen in my mother's house when the phone rings, and it was that woman who tracked me down to my mother's house via people she knew, and very tearfully said, oh my God, please, his dad and I are separated, and we don't spend that much time together, and I just wanted to bring him to a thing I knew he'd enjoy, but I don't want anyone to see this and think I'm a terrible parent. And you're going, oh my God. God.
Oh. And you're also thinking it was good stuff.
It was good stuff, but also, the whole thing, I was able to go, no, don't worry, you will never see it, because I'd already realised this is not going to work as a DVD anyway. Sure. But but you're kind of going, oh, that's that kind of... Pat Short, remember Pat Short? Part of Dunbelievable's kind of legendary Irish double act, and he was touring on his own, and he had this thing where they were masters of using the audience. It was a textbook, and they would set it up theatrically, practically, where the stage was the back bar, and where we were all sitting was the bar, let's say, in one particular show. And so they'd have people coming in and said, And they would have people on stage making sandwiches, like they'd have them, and they'd all be, and so they'd just two random audience members would be there just making sandwiches. And they'd just go, Mary and Josie are here, they're going to make sandwiches for us, we'll have a, don't you worry, John, we'll have enough sandwiches. And so they just give them, and they just let them at it. Or they'd walk a ladder through the room into the thing and then change a bulb in the thing. Yeah. And so, yeah, no, I'm in the bar, blah, blah, blah. And to the extent that I remember at the end of one of the shows, they're having a heartfelt discussion about something. I said, no, they don't, and something is wrong. And said, do you want me, John, to go into that bar and find somebody for you, John? Is that what you need me to do? And the whole room's going, oh fuck, they're coming back. And they just had created this remarkable tension. But he told me a story once that he drew of the many people he drew up on stage, he brought one once and she looked really uncomfortable, and the whole thing was supposed to dance around with him on the stage or whatever, and she leaned and whispered, "Ah, Jesus, Pat, I've just lost my husband, can I not do this, whatever, I need to swoop her back to her chair," because she couldn't be seen to be out and having fun with her husband just on the ground. I don't know if that's still the case, that you leave a trail of people who've been misrepresented.
Funnily enough, just mentioning the Nina Conti podcast again, she did some, the people she gets up out of the audience to with the masks, do the ventriloquism thing. Two of them, she was saying that she was very upset about, they were preachers. It was a question from the audience. Someone had said, I was at that gig and I walked out with the two vicars who were a couple, and they were a bit frosty and they weren't talking anymore. And she was sort of stricken. And then someone tweeted me and said, no, they're my parents and they were fine. I think it's more likely that there's a trail of happy people in the way.
I'd like to think that there is a, although you don't hear back that often. Oh, no, actually, no, you get a tweet on the night from most people. And I give them a big round of applause, and you hope that kind of makes them happy,
because that's currency to us, so let's hope it means the same to them.
Because everyone feeds off applause, isn't it? That's what we all enjoy in life. There was a guy, two nights ago in Manchester, last gig I did, who was a telephone engineer, which you prefer, down the hole or up the pole, and that was instantly the phrase became the thing. And then he didn't reappear for the second half. And I said, I'm sorry, he's gone. Where's he? Where's the telephone engineer gone? And the bloke two seats up and said, he was here for the interval. And then just left just before I started the show. And so it became a running joke about how, really he was only here for the interval. He sat through the first half of the show because he's always wanted to experience an interval. And then enjoyed the interval. And then was ready to leave. And where is he now? And we're going to leave and it's going to be an apocalyptic wasteland, but the telephone service will still be working because he was willing to sacrifice his attendance to this show to make sure the phones worked and all that thing. Turns out he got a call from his son and he had to leave. Somebody met him in a pub later. He wasn't a telephone engineer in the first place. Thing of all lies. He's a social worker, but anyway.
So just a final word on the crowd work before we move on. You likened it to the thing about improv of accepting offers and so forth. Is it a case of saying the first thing you think, or do you find yourself in situations where the first thing you think is too obvious and you have to rearrange it and go to the second thing?
Yeah, you do. There are ones where you stop yourself saying the really... because they're easy, not just because they're easy to ask, of course the first thing is it might not be that funny. So there is an element of... the second thing arrives quickly. But yeah, there is, because you do have associations with things. And you have to get past them. I mean, your brain just will follow a more well-trodden path if you allow it, and to a thing that worked previously or to all of our perception of stuff, whatever. And that's the worst. That's why you don't ever want to be somebody you know. I remember Mark Addy in the front row at something. Mark Addy from...
I know the name.
Yorkshire actor who's in Full Monty.
Yes, gotcha, of course. Yeah.
And he was in the front row in York one day. And I said, oh, hello, you're Mark Addy. And he said, hello. And I said, Mark, I can't talk to you. What am I going to say? I know who you are. I know too much about you. This, I don't know this person. I went on to the next person. Mm. And then I did. I was reading my Ticketmaster reviews, which you do once every in a blue moon, because just for the sheer thrill.
I wasn't aware that Ticketmaster had a review.
Ticketmaster has a review section, and the interesting and this feeds directly into. It's like you can read the reviews in order of when the chronological order.
Okay.
Or you could reorder them. In terms of how many stars they gave you,
okay,
both in ascending and descending order,
yeah, so whiling away the night post gig.
So, but you can imagine of all of those different,
all those different permutations. If you'd ridden one to five, you'd come out.
What is the one you're most likely to look at first? As a performer,
yeah, you want to read well.
No, that's the thing.
Good question. Because I think if there is a five, I'm going to go in with the ones and come out smiling with the fives.
Oh, see, there's loads of them because they're stacked back for years, so you never actually read through the other. And actually, the worst of it, the five is you don't bother. Oh, great, good, they enjoyed. Grand,
yeah,
fine.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's the bad fucking, ones you want
to
know.
You go straight to the bad ones. And there's one that I've always remembered because he said, oh, his show bit, he didn't like the show clearly, and he said, oh, his show bit, he spent the entire gig talking to his showbiz pal Mark Addy in the first row. You go, specifically didn't.
Yes.
And it was kind of weird because I'd been in a restaurant, there's a restaurant just next door to the theatre in York, and I had ordered some pasta dish that had little cherry tomatoes in it, and I put my fork in it and it had shot tomato juice into my eye, and everyone else in the audience was attending the show and had half an eye on the fact that I just arrived in, ordered food, and I blinded myself with the tomato. And so I went on stage and said, oh, this is a weird thing just happened. And so the two things this review read were like, his name is showbiz pal Mark Addy, and then he told a strange story about tomato, which might not even have happened. I can't win in this situation with you.
Why are you constantly writing? It doesn't sound like you're one of these. No, are you someone that goes, right, this is my writing month?
This is the 2 months in which I'm going to write on, or the 6 months basically in which I'm writing the show. So now I'm going to fling every idea that pops into your head, because you'd be exhausted. You'd be wondering, you're wandering around looking, going, is L-shaped sofas, chiffony curtains. I'm looking around the room now, like televisions.
I mean, let's be fair, Dora, five-star boutique hotel rooms.
Yeah. I mean, have we all felt that as you're looking in the city view room? Which you specifically
the
represent.
Perennial problem. It's the Streets' third album. Hey, you know what it's like when you're a millionaire.
You're gonna not do that. And there's a room in the house with loads of stuff written on walls and stuff like that. And
is there? There's the nerve center.
Yeah, and there's notepads of just shitty ideas.
And what do you, just let's, because I speak as someone who this morning sat down and had one of the, right, 2 hours, I'm just going to write stuff, let's go, all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What does that look like for you? Are you writing on a, are you writing longhand? Are you on a computer?
No,
are you
pacing around the room? No, I write to the medium, if you know what I mean. I write, so if I'm writing an article, I type it out, and I edit, so seeing how it looks on the page. And this one, it's never ever written out. It's just me talking it out, talking.
So you'll pace around your room talking.
Essentially, yeah. I will open a bottle of wine and put on some jazz music in the background. That is a recent addition to it, but not as they always. And then in the middle of the night, I do this in the middle of the night, and then I just hammer out the ideas and think about it, or I let it just sort of percolate away for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
That. Do you find that you have to convince yourself to do that? Because whenever I've, it just feels eggy. It's like, oh, I'm going to have to say stuff out loud in a room of my own now.
Yeah.
And no, when you do it, you come up with really good natural stuff.
No, actually not that much. I think that even as a teenager, that my mother would see me walking down the street to the house, she'd go, who are you talking to?
Yeah.
And I would be lips moving, right? So I quite like, whether it's daydreaming or thing, that I will talk stuff out anyway. Mm-hmm. We didn't say that I've been creating gold. I don't just idly, reconducting conversations with other 16-year-old girls who I now imagine were going much better, right? So but it is essentially that, like whatever. Yeah, I talk it out, or I walk around the kitchen doing it.
Which one of your bits would you say that? And I know we're talking about 20 years here, but what's the first one that strikes you as the bit that you're most proud of?
Oh God. There's, Yeah, you can ignore probably the first few Edinburgh shows. There's a couple of okay ones in the 99.
One in the eye there for anyone that bought a ticket.
Yeah. Well, no, not at the time. At the time, it was exciting to see a man find his voice. But it was. And then there's the kind of slightly forgotten one that only kind of did well, which was a lot of audience chat. But it had things like the dolphin routine, swimming with the dolphin routine, and it had a swimming with... there was a swimming with sharks routine, which was probably one of the most useful ones in terms of it was the straight call and response, what should you do if you're attacked by a shark? And then you would take the audience's things and play with them.
You knew what they were going to be by the time you were performing it.
Yeah, by the time you've done 15 Edinburghs. It is. Shooting with a tank, whatever. It was all ridiculous things. And then there was a bear, because again, it was topped by a story I had, and that actually worked out very well, and that has continued to work very, very well. It's an easy one. God, if I can remember the beats of it now. But that was one of the ones you went, oh, no, that's great. That just works because people will have a certain number of... It has entertaining responses within a limited context, so it's not just completely blank page.
Yes.
And it
enables you, I suppose, on some level to... You've got something prepared for almost every answer.
You end up being almost
a puppet master of like, well, that's a funny thing.
And ideally, every time there's a genuinely strange or interesting one that you can really mess around with. So I remember that one working very, very well and being a really finale, because also then it had the topper. It was all tied back into a particular story. And the story had a big punchline. You know, the ones that have a thing that I'll clap at the end. Jesus, you hold those ones close to your heart. They'll do that. And then there's a few. I mean, occasionally you have what you regard as a hit, but you've no idea if they are. I mean, the show that you showed, This Is the Show, that was probably the one that had between the video game routine or the episiotomy routine, Dr. Bear. Mm-hmm. Although I did that routine 150 times. And on night 148, realized that if I just swapped the first half and the second half, it actually balanced much better. So, yeah, well, at that point, it was, yeah.
When you mentioned the computer games routine.
Yeah.
That, what struck me about that is that you managed to take a topic which might be alienating to certain portions of the audience. I think as soon as you mention computer games, there's an understandable kind of, oh, this bit isn't for me. But you manage to find a kind of an universal angle within it. And I think that's something you're incredibly good at, is taking an unusual, or taking a topic that's completely accessible, but without touching on anything that would make it trite or previously covered.
It is a thing. I mean, you've got to keep an ear on what they know and listen to their reaction about stuff. There's a routine about helium depletion in this particular show, which is at times not only a tough sell, but it's a technical fact about helium.
We're running out of helium, aren't we?
There's a bit where I just go, we're running out of helium. There's like a silence in the room. And I go, yeah, I know. You just need that fact for the routine. About to do, and weirdly, I remember Ed saying this to me about another routine about the routine about the film 2012, and he said I hate you for that, because he said no one has seen that film, but so it isn't like it's a popular response, but I just got the right amount of explanation or just the amount of genre thing into it.
Yes, even if they hadn't seen it, people knew what it was. It's a disaster movie.
And once you've established that, then you can be silly with it. But it is an awkward thing that it is. We presume things are universal where they're not. I mean, I have struggled on this show to make universal an observation about how dark dramas are at the moment and how grim they are, and how they're always about, and how now they're all about a murdered child. And 30 years ago it was about Jessica Fletcher, and there was a dowager who was killed because of her will was being disputed.
Yes.
And now there's a kid being washed up on a beach, and you can't finish a show with a kid with and I have only now realized that is possibly the way to bring it in, but I've tried to say this as an observation.
Yes.
And I think you have to be at a particular stage. It's like doing stuff about kids. You have to be at a stage in your life where you recoil from, oh God, a dead kid. I don't want to see a show. I've got kids. I don't want to see a show about a dead kid. But that's not as universal. That's only a certain age of life. It's like you never do stuff about babies. Never do stuff about babies. Because only people who have babies care. And then they stop caring. And people before babies hate the idea of to switch off.
So is there an internal kind of I don't know what the word is. There's an internal decision that you, decisions are internal that you have to make about whether to talk about stuff that you feel passionately about, but you maybe can't talk about in as much detail as you'd like to, or because actually they won't necessarily come with you because.
I think I'm a professional entertainer, like, so I can't just I'm there to do. I'm putting on a show, so I have to. I have to go to them to a certain extent. I mean, I more than a lot of people get to indulge certain passions and and topics. You know, helium depletion being a good example. But let's not pat myself in the back and say I'm some sort of renegade who took the audience where they weren't expecting to go. You know, there, because I am aware that this has to be made entertaining or interesting to people. The I'm doing popular science. I'm not doing, you know, I'm not doing an academic textbook. You know, that if that's the parallel you could draw. So the so you need to have half an ear on the fact that on what they will be interested in, and also there's stuff that you could give your angry stance on something, but are you going to give that 150 times? Do you think you can push that through for a year and a half? Because the tour is 2 years probably. Will this? And it's not like as cynical as me going, well, I've got to do the show in Norway, so you know, will they get this in Norway? I better not do it now. But the but there is still an element of like, it's not a bad thing to look for the universal. And it was one of the reasons that I always felt that the Edinburgh Festival was very good for Irish comics and very bad for Scottish comics, because I remember seeing Scottish comics do People in Dundee Walk Like This and People in Glasgow Walk Like That type stuff here, and getting enough of an applause to be delighted with themselves. And you're kind of going, I can't do hey, People in Cork are, isn't it funny the way people in Cork are? I have to find something really universal that works in this international
crowd. It pushes you harder.
Yeah, pushes more, because we'd know the stuff, our safety blanket stuff, our easy kind of, I'm going to play off the easy prejudices we all have, like, or the jokes we all already know. You can't do them because I'm in a different country now. Oh, Jesus, I better find the thing which is universal. And so it was good for us to do. So there is a touch of trying to find that in what you do.
Did you find as a less experienced comic? Because there's obviously something like you're someone who, like, the things we've talked about, you're kind of accessible to lots of people. Mm. You've obviously got that kind of conversational quality that is really sort of attractive to an audience. But you know, you're one of the people who has. Really?
I'm going to stop saying yes to every nice thing you say, because how appalling that sounds. I have.
Listeners, Dara fell into the trap where I butter him up and he just took it all.
Yes, I am accessible to all audiences.
You obviously have kind of made it to an extent that not every Irish comic coming out of Dublin when you started has made it.
Okay.
And I'm interested in what you think the differences were, if there were differences. I mean, it's not just luck, is it? What are the things that set you apart from your peers?
Taking the premise of it in the least flattering way I possibly can.
Sure.
Right, okay, why have I become preeminent and ubiquitous in a way that more talented, more interesting comics may not have?
Your ability to formulate a sentence like that is presumably part of it, but yes,
there is an element of I have I know that I have a kind of a polish or a warmth or whatever, which makes me very, very palatable. I work a lot. I write lots of jokes and coming up with stuff. And you can stick me into anything. And I'll generally, I'm doing stargazing 1 week and then the next. So I'm next to that curiosity drive. So we can say that. There aren't a lot of people who go, what the fuck are you doing on that show? All you do is interrupt Brian Cox.
Sure.
Which I get a lot of.
There are a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
Daily Mail would be one of them. To which I say, it's a live television show, and if somebody doesn't interrupt him, he would still be talking. But why that? I think there is an element of you can only control certain factors, like I suppose the warmth, but you can certainly control the amount of work you do. But there is a luck element to it as well, that that just I happen to not to discount it entirely, but like, I mean, there was an element of the right place at the right time that Angus Deaton got involved in a sex scandal, and then they got loads of different people in to do Have I Got News For You. Mm-hmm. That opportunity hadn't appeared for 10 years on a panel show. That we were around at the same time as loads of digital channels, including one that just wanted just these kind of shows. So we became preeminent because we were there at the time when Dave needed to fill its schedules with stuff. Mm-hmm. So suddenly we were all over the place, where everyone gets to know us really, really well. The things like that, we're part of a lucky generation, which may not occur. I mean, there, if you like, you know, Dylan is a for example is a fabulous comedian, but doesn't particularly want to do this kind of stuff. That'd be a good case of it. You know, I don't think it's a case of, you know, it's as long as I'm here, I'm fulfilling some sort of quota. I don't think it particularly works for you know, for Irish people, as you can see.
Is there some element to which I wonder about? It's funny, we never talk about management on this podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like certainly you're with Off the Curve.
Oh, that's great. We're very good. Yeah,
they're
yeah.
very good. And yeah, yeah. something that I was party to a conversation between an Off the Curve agent and an Off the Curve act recently, whereby the agent was saying, by all means, do a show that has a theme,
yeah,
but let's not forget that what I need to sell are sections to go on TV shows. And yeah. I'm paraphrasing, and that's part of why it's not just modesty that prevents me from saying who, but it's also I feel like I'm misquoting slightly. But I do wonder if there's a sense in which you're writing a tour, and it must be some part of the process that you're going, right, this section is going to work on Apollo, this section I'll be able to burn on
Actually,
Comedy Central.
Well, it's not quite. You do think in terms of how will this work as a two-hour show, as a probably 90-minute DVD, and as a 1 hour when it eventually goes to the show. And then you kind of lament what's going to be left out. But you don't write it really for that. You let the editing of that look after itself later. It's a bit of a headache on given years. What can I turn into an Apollo type set, because I think I'm doing the Apollo this year, it's the first time I've done it in a couple of years, and you kind of go, oh well, does that routine or this, or do I do a really good long routine or do a short routine? So, but you've got 2 hours of material, so you've got stuff to choose from.
Yes.
I think it's very different. Very rarely will you have somebody who doesn't think in different scales within the same tour show anyway, that you're kind of going, there isn't stuff that can be extracted. And then our dirty secret, how much of this could work as a corporate gig? How much does this work for 10 minutes in front of...
Yes, I remember the first time I did a corporate gig where I think I'd just finished my second hour at Edinburgh, and for the first time I had a choice of stuff that I could do. My God, that was a good feeling.
Yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
This, my best bit is all to do with sex. That's not going to work. Oh, Christ, what else can I scrape together?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And for the first time going, no, that'll do nicely. That bit will do and that bit will do.
Yeah, no, there is... And that is your most general audience that you'll ever play to. And so you do...
Your most general audience.
General, in the sense, the most just randomly plucked strangers.
Not fans, not necessarily comedy goers.
Yeah, not having come to you. They're just like, they're just a slice of the population. And for that, you've got to presume that, particularly because they're in tuxedos sitting around tables, not necessarily facing you even, they're not going to go, oh, tell us a long story. Tell us a long anecdote that'll be, even, you know, that self-story.
During which we can break out into chats amongst ourselves about how much we're not enjoying it.
But it is you still write the shows for the shows. But it's not like, it's less of a thing for me because I'm still a bloke in a suit telling jokes, which, let's face it, Off the Curve are very fond of as a thing, but like they didn't create that. That was already there. But Mock the Week, for example, wouldn't suit me. I wouldn't guest on Mock the Week, I don't think, because it wouldn't necessarily suit me. I don't do that many one-liners, you know.
Yes.
Would I Lie to You suits me more as a more spiel-y type thing.
Can we talk about Andrew Lawrence?
Yeah, you can, by all means, absolutely, yeah. I was my major gripe with some of the coverage on Andrew Lawrence was presumed that I was part of any kind of group of people who weighed in heavily on him. My reaction to Andrew, I never publicly tweeted, although obviously all tweets are in the situation are public, but I never sent a general thing out. I sent a message to him disagreeing with his characterization of, plus because where people were very angry about Andrew and his comments about women comedians or ethnics, I believe is the term he used, nobody, I think, properly realized the hurt caused to fat, bald, Asian comedians on Mock the Week, who I can speak for with some authority, found it enormously irritating as a thing. The notion that I in particular, adopt this political stance because you think it'll get more work from the BBC. And
yes,
I made the point that as an immigrant, I reserve the right to be opposed to anti-immigrant politics, which led to a whole world of shite from people. Going, you're not an immigrant. You can't say you're an immigrant. And I go, I have to get on a plane to see my mother. I am an immigrant. I have to go to passport control to go to where I'm from. I'm an immigrant. But it was a weird thing. He may object to the people's take to UKIP grant, but there is an element of with all of the UKIP, the whining about not being taken seriously, and at the same time looking for special privilege of not being joked about, and that isn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. We get particularly around the time of when it's the when things would be around the time of the conferences, where it's literally we're doing the Labour conference 1 week and the Tory conference the next week and the Lib Dem conference the next week. Every week somebody sends you in the timings going, you did, it was all about the Tories this week, and she goes, yes, because it's the Tory conference. Yes. That's the story we're doing, and next week we'll do the Labour conference and we'll get another. And I've retweeted tweets going from both sides, left and right, going, this show is biased, you know. Yes. The way that we could be regarded as hateful and misogynistic and patriarchal and also left wing. Yes. We've been called all these things as a show.
And do you feel, for someone that said, that described yourself as, look, I'm a professional entertainer.
Yeah.
What's your relationship to politics if you're an entertainer? Do you feel that you have any kind of responsibility to either, is the responsibility only to be balanced? Or is there a responsibility to...
Yeah, I know. It's difficult not to, difficult to remove your own politics. I mean, it would take a genius to work out where I stand on things, but I don't publicly declare it because I think that, if for no other reason, it's just people just then will lob it at you forever. They do anyway. They presume you're on the BBC, so therefore you're a... screaming leftist, lefty anyway.
Or right wing if you talk to a Scot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's a I reserve everyone's right to do whatever they want with this. Like we have a soapbox that we can use if you want. I find the main reason I don't do a lot of politics stuff in the show because it'll tour for a year and a half, and so the point where that's fresh and that story is exciting. Like, I mean, I would have passed through an entire generation of politics if I found myself with a 10-minute Miliband routine now, and then one night. It's like, oh God, you know. So I don't specifically write for it. I'll keep what I do for thing. But I will score, you know, the idea. And it's not like this ridiculous, you know, I'm an equal opportunities offender. That ridiculous line. But what you're looking for in terms of comedy isn't what you're looking for in an argument politically. And so the arguments I make online about political stuff, or the currently in the referenda that are on in Ireland, for example, that I can't even vote in, but I don't know why I'm weighing in, will usually be like a rational, I believe, hope a rational response to making an argument about these things. Whereas when it's the show, I'm looking for a silly thing to make funny about. So you're not trying to... We've a couple of times we've had people who specifically tried to go, yeah, and made a big political rant and got... And there's a sort of a beat where the audience go, oh, okay, and giving them a clap. And it's really clunking. Yeah, so I don't know the work. So no, I'm not... I wouldn't be an especially political comedian because I don't think that's where I find the funny in things. I wish Andrew very well in his career. And the weirdest thing for me is... Andrew was doing preview gigs the same time I was doing preview gigs.
Yes.
The same night in Maff's club, Maff Brown's club.
Outside the box,
yeah. And we were in that small tented area that they have at the side of the stage, and for 4 weeks in a row that summer. And it was all chat, chat, chat. Hey, how are you? How's it going? Hope it's going well. Is it all come together for the show? All that was going on. Then fat, bald, middle-aged comedians pretending to be, and you're going, wow, really? You know, and then I made the point to him, and he just went equally, he was equally belligerent.
And you haven't seen him follow-up since?
Our paths hardly crossed in all the years that we've known each other. And nor did I expect him to. I remember some dressing room on this tour, his poster was up on the wall. Long list of it. Oh, Wolverhampton, his poster was up on the wall. But I didn't do anything to it. I didn't like, you know, to face the poster or anything childish. Yeah.